The year is 1967. Shortly after Catherine Switzer passes the first mile marker of the Boston Marathon, the race director, furious to see a woman running in, quotes, his race, jumps off the press truck and attempts to rip off her number and pull her from the course. Switzer's boyfriend, who is running nearby, happens to be an All-American football player and gives the race director a body block for the ages. Switzer collects herself and goes on to not only become the first woman to officially finish the Boston Marathon, but to also help change the course of women's running worldwide. Welcome to the latest episode of the Catalyst Health, Wellness, and Performance Coaching Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bradford Cooper of the Catalyst Coaching Institute, and it is my incredible pleasure to welcome the one and only Catherine Switzer to the show. For those of you who are health and wellness coaches or heading that way, we are really excited to announce the Rocky Mountain Coaching Retreat and Symposium in magnificent Estes Park, Colorado is a go for September 17th through the 19th this year. The super early registration discount is currently available for this incredible event, and it's designed specifically for health and wellness coaches. All the details at catalystcoachinginstitute.com, or feel free, reach out to us anytime about this or the upcoming MBHWC coaching certification. Results at catalystcoachinginstitute.com. We're happy to set up a time to chat. Now, let's hear the rest of the story with Catherine Switzer and what happened before, during, and after one of the most iconic photos in sports came to be on the latest episode of the Catalyst Health, Wellness, and Performance Coaching Podcast. Well, Catherine, it's such a privilege. This is so much fun. I appreciate you jumping on with us. Thanks for joining us on the Catalyst Health, Wellness, and Performance Coaching Podcast.
So happy to be here, Brad. I mean, it's so great. And I really salute what you guys are doing. I think this is really tremendous to get the message out there and keep spreading it through the training program.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So listeners know the essence of your story. I've set it up in the intro, but let me just say a little bit of that back. It's like picture perfect. You're out there. You're the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon. The race director, who's obviously a knucklehead, tries to grab your number, push you off the course. Your boyfriend, who just happens to be an All-American football player, puts one of the greatest cross blocks we've ever seen right in front of the press truck. So walk us through that's the basics. That's the setup. That's the pictures people have seen, maybe a little video clip. But walk us through what happened that day. What was going on in your mind, on the course, et cetera, et cetera.
So it's important to know, first of all, that I wasn't at the Boston Marathon to prove anything. You know, I was there because I wanted to run. Mm. And actually, it was a reward from my coach. He said to me in practice one day, no woman could ever run a marathon. And we argued. I gave him all the women in history who I knew who had run a marathon, not without any fanfare. And even Roberta Gibb jumping out of the bushes at Boston in 1966. He wouldn't believe it. He was like so many guys who just in those days, you believe, well, people. Sure. You have a narrow view of what capability is,
right.
And they just can't make the leap. And we argued, and we were on the run together, and he said, if you showed me in practice, I'd be the first person to take you, which is like number one coaching tip, right? Have a goal.
Set the target.
Focus.
And aim for it.
Target. Have a challenge even.
Yeah.
And have somebody tell you you're not capable of doing it. But also a buddy. You know, I had a buddy. He was my training partner. And, I didn't mess around after that. I was, did all the hard runs. Anyway, when I did it in practice, we instead of 26.2 miles, I didn't think we'd gone far enough. And we ran, this is historic part. We actually ran 31 miles. And he passed out at the end of the workout. And when he came to, he said, women have hidden potential in endurance and stamina. And I kind of was knowing this because the guys on the cross country team would never come and run with us if we went more than 15 miles. So they thought we were crazy people. But the further we went, the better I felt. And so anyway, we discovered this amazing thing. So Arnie was the guy who helped me sign up for the race, insisting I sign up, that it was a serious race, had to pay my $2 entry fee and present my AAU card, et cetera. And of course, I famously signed my name KV Switzer, which if officials obviously thought I was a guy. And when I got to Boston, all the men were wonderful to me. I was really happy. I knew I could finish the race. And then came that amazing incident in a mile and a half where the official completely lost his temper. I mean, it was a bad day. It was sleeting, snowing, headwind. You're trying to get the race off on time. he felt that I was a clown in his race. I was trying to make him look like a fool by wearing numbers. And you know, we were all dressed alike because it was so cold. We all looked alike. We looked like refugees, really. And wearing our baggy sweats and trying to stay warm. I was disappointed because I wanted to show off my cute shorts and top. But, I mean, you know, it was freezing. But he was out of control. And so we went from being really happy and laughing at the beginning of a marathon, like you often are.
To especially the first mile of Boston.
Always. Yeah, it's downhill. What's not to love, you know? And suddenly, when he came after me and attacked me, he was so out of control. I'd never seen such a fierce face, and I'd never, you know, been attacked by anybody or hit in my life. I couldn't get away from him, and it was almost comic because I was trying to run, and he was pulling me back by the sweatshirt, and he was trying to rip my bib off.
Nice. That's awesome.
This is the one he got on the back because he got the corner of it. It's obviously not the real bib, but it's close enough, right? But my coach Arnie was screaming at him, "Leave her alone! She's okay. I've trained her. Leave her alone!" And he just smacked my coach, and then he came back after me and Tom, my boyfriend, 235 pounds, only running because if a girl could run,
right,
he could run. I couldn't convince him not to come to Boston. He couldn't. He hadn't trained. He'd probably never run more than a mile in his life. Weighed 235 pounds. No
optimal marathon weight. Yeah,
absolutely. Great height weight ratio. I said, "Tom, you know, don't do this." And he said, "If a girl can do it, I can do it."
Famous last words.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so he came in handy, knocked the official away. And then we all ran like hell, you know, past the press truck and the press truck after us and yelling and screaming and you know, when are you going to quit? Really, really being very tough on me. And we, you know, here we are laughing about it. But it was really a terrible moment.
Sure.
Really terrible. I was terrified. I mean, I was 20, right? And I was humiliated. I was made to feel small. I just for a split second wanted to go home to my mom.
Sure.
And then I knew if I did that, though, nobody would believe I could do it. And nobody would believe women could do it.
Right.
And women, this is just the eve of the women's liberation movement, you know, the 67.
1967.
Women were pilloried for always barging into places where they're not welcome and they can't do it anyway. Mm. Well, of course you can't do it anyway if somebody's going to jump on you like that and humiliate you and you know, and but my coach said, run like hell. And then I got so determined. I said, you know, I'm going to finish this race on my hands and my knees if I have to, because if I don't, nobody's going to believe women can do it. And that was the turning point in my life. And I think we all have one of those. It's maybe not quite so dramatic, but it's the moment when we make the decision to take responsibility and finish the job, right?
Well,
that's what destiny is to me.
And I
was not quitting. Nothing was going to.
Well, that's what I said. You took it. You talk about we all have that opportunity. There's a big difference between an opportunity and taking the opportunity. You took that opportunity, Catherine. And I can't imagine it, when you talk about physiology and endorphins and all that kind of stuff, this didn't happen at mile 24 and you just needed to get across the finish line. You're at mile 1.5 and you've just burned all this nervous energy. You've just got all these endorphins have gone through the roof. You've got the fight flight kicking in and you've just started. I mean, that had to be so difficult just physiologically after going through that.
It was, we all went into a trough. It was really interesting. It was almost like kind of going unconscious. And I just kept running and it was interesting. I thought once you lost all your adrenaline like that, you couldn't get it back, but we just gradually did get it back. Mm-hmm. And we've all had the experience where a car just misses us or a dog goes after us or something this. And then you go, oh God, you're exhausted. And we sort of came out of this anesthesia at about 10Ks. And then slowly waking up and picking up and picking up and picking up. And I got feeling better and better and better. And then the other crisis point, of course, is always Heartbreak Hill at 21 miles, right? Yep. When you lose all your glycogen. And at that point, it was interesting because I didn't lose my glycogen, but I lost a lot of negative emotion. And I always say, you can't run 20 miles and stay mad. And I had murdered the official every way I could until 20 miles. And then I forgave him. I said, it's not his fault.
Wow.
He's a product of his time.
Wow.
You know, and I said, it's going to be women like me who are going to have to change the system. And I got really angry at other women. I said, why aren't they here? What's wrong with these women? You know, they're not out here and they're not feeling great like I'm feeling and powerful. And then I did one of those. I said, you stupid girl. You know, you had a parents who encouraged you. You guys on the team, Arnie's, you know, been running with you. Most women never had those opportunities. Mm. And so they were afraid. And they were afraid of all the old myths. And I'm sure you've heard them. I mean, you're in the biz. I mean, and they still exist around the world today. You know, your uterus is going to fall out. You're going to turn into a man. You're going to grow hair in your chest. You're going to get big legs. All the things that would scare women who only had their femininity,
sure,
didn't have an opportunity to be powerful. And you couldn't convince them that this was going to be one of the best things they could ever do for themselves in terms of their health and beauty and fitness or whatever.
Right.
And I thought, okay, you know, boing, eureka moment. I've got to change that. And when I finished the race, I swear to God, I felt better than at any point in the whole race, except for the beginning. I could have run all the way back to Hopkinton. I had this life plan, man.
Wow.
I tell you.
Wow.
And it was a matter of creating those opportunities. But the other one, and I know you want to discuss this, is I finished in 4 hours and 20 minutes. My coach kept saying, we're going to slow down because if you want to finish and finish strong, we've got to slow down just for safety's sake. I said, okay. So we finished in 4 hours and 20 minutes. I had plenty left, but I knew I was going to be pilloried because 4 hours and 20 minutes in 1967 was considered a jogging race. And the guy who attacked me, Jock Semple, said in a press conference the next day, 4 hours, 20 minutes. I could have walked it that fast. I was so furious. Okay. I'm going to try to become an athlete. And up to that point, everybody was saying, you're not really an athlete. You're really just running long. You know, you're a jogger. And I said, okay, let's see if I can. I'm an ordinary person. Ordinary jogger.
A lot of people dispute that one, but keep going.
I know, but you know, you can look at your basic mile time or your basic 400 meter time.
Yeah.
Okay. And I mean, I had to train my brains out to get under 63 seconds for 400. I mean, that's translating that. That ain't world class.
Sure.
But I worked hard. I worked really, really hard. I got myself up to training over 100 miles a week. Double workouts. You know, I ran a marathon distance, 27 miles every Sunday. So I had super endurance. I probably should have been an ultra runner.
Yeah. If it were a thing back then, right? Because this is late 60s, early, are we in early 70s at this point, or is this more 68, 69?
Yeah, no. I started moving into serious training around 73.
Okay.
72, 73.
Okay.
Up to that point, I just ran long.
Got it.
But I was running double workouts. And just running long and running double workouts, and I was doing a slow 100 miles a week sometimes, I did get my marathon time down to 3:15, no problem. I mean, I went from 4:20 to 3:15. I mean, I could roll out of bed and run it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you didn't stop there. I know where you ended up. This is super impressive, everybody.
But from 3:15 down to 2:51 took so much work.
Yeah.
Oh, jeepers, lots and lots of fast intervals. The point is this. This ordinary person could do it. You know, I mean, I trained hard. I was lucky I didn't get injured, maybe, because I mean, we had crap shoes and equipment. But I did that. And the capacity for human achievement astonishes me.
Yeah.
And it has always astonished me. That's one reason why I've been running for 63 years, is it's always magic. And then in terms of its
what it produces
return.
Right.
And it's always magic in terms of what physically you can do. It is fascinating.
Yeah.
And I had that. I'm taking over your whole interview.
Yeah, that's what you're here for. We love it. Nobody's complaining. They've heard from me enough.
It was fascinating again when I trained up to run the Boston Marathon again 50 years later in 2017. And no woman had done that, but that's not credit to me. It's how few women used to run 50 years ago. But I was in shape and I thought I could train up for it again. And I ran then in 2017, I only ran 24 minutes slower than I did on my first one when I was 20. And the same training, you know, kicked in, you know, in the 2 years before. I took 2 years to gear up. And, you know, I had to do some 4 and 5 hour runs because that's how long it was going to take me, you know. But is it funny? The body responds at any age. It was phenomenal to feel that same kind of thrill. You know, I would finish a 4 or 5 hour run and I would just come home and go, yay, damn beauty.
Oh, I love this.
Yeah.
So, okay. So much to unpack here. I've got a list of questions, but I have a feeling they're going out the door because you've given us a lot of rundown here. So let's first talk about you. You're 20 years old. What formed you? You gave credit to your parents, the support, your coach. Were there books that really drove you? Was there music that was in your head saying, you know, you can do better. You know, you can stand in that gap. What was it that made you unique? Because we talked about you got the opportunity. We all get an opportunity at some point. But you took it. Why did Catherine take it? What makes you who you? What makes you back then? I want to explore the next several years. But what at age 20 had helped form that person that was willing to take such a risk and to push through such a frankly scary situation?
It was. I often look at that picture. I look at that face and I said, "How did a 20-year-old girl make that decision?" You go back to age 12. The night my father said, you don't want to be a cheerleader, cheerleaders cheer for other people. You need to participate. Life is to participate. So, you know, come on. I was the luckiest girl in the world to have parents like that. And my dad took me outside and he said, honey, you run a mile a day. You're going to be the best player in your field hockey team in high school when you go to high school. And I started running a mile a day and it was the sense of empowerment that changed my heart because I was scared. I was only 12 going to high school. And in an advanced stream, don't do this to your kids. I mean, I could never catch up. I always felt like I could never catch up. I was running a mile a day when I knew nobody else was running a mile a day. And it made me feel like I had a victory nobody could take away from me.
Right.
And that's why I've been running for 63 years. I mean, because I still have that sense of empowerment and fearlessness. And I'm trying to give it to as many women as possible, which is another story. But
yeah, we'll talk about
that. That's what gave me the courage then to, when I was at Syracuse University, to go to the men's track coach and ask if I could run on the men's track team. And he said, no, you can't officially, but we'd welcome you to come and train with the team if you wanted to. He thought I'd never show up. And when I showed up, that's the other thing, is it gives you the courage to show up.
Yeah.
So I showed up. Yeah. And he was stunned. And the assistant coach, who was a volunteer, was the university mailman. And he was the guy, Arne Briggs, who had run 15 Boston marathons. And he was just a simple guy. I mean, sweet.
Who became your coach, everyone? Arne became your coach. Yeah.
But he wasn't a coach. He was the mailman.
Yeah.
And I often say from a really simple, kind heart, you can learn so much, you know, really pay attention to ordinary people. You know, I learned more from Arne Briggs, the mailman, than I did from all the professors in my undergraduate and graduate degree. I swear to you. And he taught me more about life just by being nice. And it was phenomenal. So all of those things counted so that I had my mom and dad. And then I had the guys on the cross country team were great to me. And then Arne, who first didn't believe a woman could run the distance. And then when I proved to him, he kept his promise. He said he was going to take me to Boston and he did. A 50-year-old man put himself on the line for a 19-year-old girl to go to the Boston Marathon. How big is that? I mean, incredible.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I mean, I'm not sure I could do it now. I try, but it's a big risk.
Yeah.
That's what gave me the guts. There you go.
Wow. Yeah, okay, so you're the first guest to make me cry. all right. We've talked about some of this, but after the race was complete, what type of response did you get from those outside of your inner circle? Obviously, your inner circle is probably like, way to go, you're awesome, way to go. But what were you hearing from other men and women as you went forward?
It was totally polarized, Brad. I was getting buckets of fan mail, you know. We've got your picture from the newspaper on your mantle, you know.
Folks, if you have not seen this, you have to look this up. We'll include it with this, but seriously, if you haven't seen this, it is all time. Sorry, keep going.
Well, it's one of 100 photos that changed the world.
Yes,
supposedly.
Clearly.
Yeah. I mean, it was coincidence. I mean, it's just absolute coincidence that happened at that moment.
Well, just as far as the type of response you received, you got your fan mail, but my understanding is it wasn't all, even from the women, it wasn't necessarily all positive. Is that right?
Some of it was awful. You know, you're going to fry in hell. God's going to get you. This is not the Christian thing to do. Really, it's disgraceful. You're sweating in public. You know, on and on and on with all these myths. Spectators were not so hot either. Some of the men would shout, "You should be home in the kitchen making dinner for your husband." But you know what? I sat around with my roommates when this mail would come in, and we'd hand out the hate mail, and we would laugh hilariously. Okay? And bin it. Boom, right? But the fan mail we kept.
Wow. That is so cool.
There were some funny ones. There was a butcher from Alabama who wrote and proposed marriage. And all the guys, there were a lot of letters from guys in Vietnam, you know, and I felt so sorry for them. And they were, some of them were saying, you know, "I ran track at Yale and, you know, here I am in Nam. Would you write back to me?" And
wow. Kind of stuff. Very cool. Yeah. You know, I'm sure everybody wants to know, whatever happened to your boyfriend, the guy that made the great cross block?
God. Oh my God. Oh my God. You ready for this story?
We're ready. Bring this one.
Okay, well, hero to zero to hero.
Of course.
Zero to zero, but zero again, unfortunately. Okay, so he knocked the official away. And then when we were running again and the official he actually got up and got on the bus and came by and cursed at us and then went up to the start of the race. You know what everybody did to him, right? But at
oh
any
my
rate,
gosh.
So now the press truck's away, gone away. And Tom turns to me and he said, "You're getting me in all kinds of trouble." I said, "What do you mean? I'm getting you in all kinds of trouble." He said, "I hit an official. And they took my picture hitting an official. I'm going to get expelled from the Amateur Athletic Union. And I am not going to make the Olympic team. And it's all your fault. And you have ruined my Olympic dream."
This is in the middle of the race.
In the middle of the race. Now, boyfriend-girlfriend argument in the middle of the race. I mean, everybody's embarrassed, you know. You've seen people argue in a couple in a restaurant and everybody in the whole restaurant.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
But you can't move, right?
You're stuck.
You can't get up.
Right.
And so you're running in the Boston Marathon. Everybody's looking around trying to avoid us. And I'm crying, right? Because he's humiliating me. And he said, "And besides that, you run too slow anyway." And took off. Right? Okay. You're smiling.
I don't think he finishes this race is what I think is going to happen here.
Wait for it. 13 miles going up the hill right into Wellesley. I saw his sweatshirt up there. And Arnie said to me, "Gee, do you think that's Tom?" I said, "Hey, no kidding, it's Tom. For God's sake, he's an orange sweatshirt."
Can you see the target on his back?
Well, I caught up to him and then he started jogging like I hadn't been watching him walk, right? And then he goes, "Oh man, am I tired?" And I said, "Yeah, it's a long way." You know, at that point, everything you say is going to be awful. So he said, I'll get it back. And I said, "Call a taxi." Because you don't get it back if you're walking at 13.
No, you do not.
And he said, and he starts jogging again. And he said, "Walk with me. If you walk with me, I'll get it back." I said, "Tom, I can't walk with you." And he said, "I'm going slow, but I've got momentum. I'm going to lose my momentum. Bye. Catch the sweep truck." He said, "Thanks a lot." And I said, "No, the sweep truck picks up the wounded and the lame. We'll see you at the finish." 100 yards down the road, I hear, "I'd never leave you."
Oh, no. Yeah. So was that the end of this thing? Were you guys race over, relationships over?
Well, I said to Arnie. Arnie said, "Oh, just let him go." And I said, "Go, he's gone. You know, there goes that relationship." I mean, it was pretty serious. You know what that means?
Sure.
Going steady. Okay. So we get to the finish. All the interviews, the journalists are there. Not all four.
Sure.
And we have blankets around us. It's really bitter cold, and we're really cold, and we can't find Tom anywhere, and nobody's heard of a sweep truck. I said, "Oh God, Arnie, he's lost someplace in Boston." And he said, "Well, what are we going to do?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "I mean, we're freezing." So we waited an hour and 15 minutes. By that time, we were absolutely purple. And Arnie said, "We're going. We've got to go." And we, as we left the area, I looked right up Boylston Street one last time, and I saw Tom coming down to the finish like this. And I, no, we got excited. We said, Tom, you did it. You did it. And he said, the damn sweep truck never came. Anyway, we rode back to Syracuse that night, 6 hours in the car. We're in the back seat, all kissy face. You know, the endorphins had all kicked in and everything. He was so happy. Boy, look at us. We're cool, you know. And we got engaged.
Wow. I didn't think it was going to end that way.
No, we got engaged. We got married next year. We got divorced 5 years later.
Wow.
Don't ask why we got married. It's way too complicated. But needless to say, it was a competitive relationship. And I often say to people, have fun with your endorphins, but don't make serious decisions.
All right. Well, that was good. I don't think most people know that story.
I'm glad I'm laughing about it. It was a sad relationship because he was really talented. This is, I guess, a good thing to say to people, okay? He was really gifted as an athlete, and I was not. And I was always told, oh, you're just a jogger. You're just a little plow horse, and I'm a thoroughbred. That was a comparison he always used. So I trained my brains out, and because he was talented, he didn't think he needed to train. Mm. And he thought the world owed him a living. And we see this all the time with really talented people who think the world owes
not just in athletics.
And you just in everything. Yeah. Right. And he was that way in everything. Mm. And it was heartbreaking. It was a real tortoise and a hare story. And when I left, he was surprised. How could you be surprised?
Wow.
But anyway, I learned a lot from that.
Wow.
As I always do.
So let's jump back to running itself, because at the time you did this, the longest, and when I looked this up, I knew generally the facts on this, but I was still stunned. Less than a mile in the Olympics was the longest women's race. Less than a mile, 1,500 meters.
No, in 1967, the longest Olympic race was only 800 meters.
Oh, it was. I thought it was 1,500.
Wow. They reinstated the women's 800 in 1960 in Rome after the 1928 Olympics, where they threw the event out because they said this is too arduous for women.
Wow.
And they went to 400 meters, and then in 60 in Rome, 800 meters. In 72, they put the 1,500.
And then just less than 20 years later, 84, marathon is an Olympic event. Do you think, or have you heard feedback that your race was a tipping point for that? Obviously, Joan Benoit shocked the world, you know, really put things on another map in 84, but something led to that. Some things led to that. You clearly were part of that.
Yeah, that was really my main career. When I finished the Boston Marathon in 67, I did become a better athlete. I explained that part of the story. But the
251, everybody.
In Boston again, 75, tailwind.
You don't have to say that part.
Yeah, well, it was. Billy Rogers confessed too, you know. Anyway. Then I create the opportunity, cut a long story short. I began writing business proposals. I formed a small club in Syracuse. I learned how to do marketing and managing and public relations and sponsorship proposals. And I took them after I was at the Munich Olympics in 72. And I realized, among all the terror and horror and everything else, that that's where I saw the commercialism and the sponsorship. And I said, my God, that's what's going to make women's running happen. It's going to be Kodak, IBM, Mercedes-Benz, Deutsche Bank. It's not going to be a used car dealer trophy. So I wrote a proposal, and I took it on a flyer, absolutely on a flyer, to Avon Cosmetics, which was the world's largest cosmetics company at the time. And I packaged a series of women's races in a engaging and feminine way. Women only, make it jewelry, don't make it trophies, make lots of flowers, great food, and a competitive opportunity up front. But anybody is welcome.
Right.
And make it welcoming and non-intimidating. And the women only thing I was pilloried for, because how could you, who integrated running, do this? Because
interesting.
The IOC wasn't going to listen to us if we had men in the race, because the IOC, International Olympic Committee, was saying, oh, women will be paced by men. And I wanted to show that they could do it on their own.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a heyday. Women were running great. It was Greta Bites and John Benoit and Rosa Mota, Ingrid Christensen. They were hot. And I thought, hey, listen, with that kind of performance. And then we got the medical data together to refute the old myth. And actually, the data came back was fascinating. It showed that women have more endurance than men.
Yeah, exactly.
Stamina, and that the marathon is a lot better for them than the shot put.
Yeah.
Okay. So why are we denying them this opportunity? So lobbying the IOC through John Holt at the IAAF. And then I went to Peter Uberoth and his gang out in Los Angeles. And we had, by that time, the requisite number of countries. We were, the Olympic requirement was 24 countries, three continents. And in our final, not our final, but our big marathon in London, by the way, which closed London streets for the first time in history for sports.
Interesting.
Event.
And now it's one of the classics.
I know. It was a design model for the London Marathon, actually. But in 1980, we had five continents in 27 countries. So the IOC voted us in for the Olympics in 1984.
Wow.
And it, to me, I'll tell you the truth, it was as significant as giving women the right to vote in 1920, because it was, to me, the physical equivalent of what we had accomplished socially and intellectually.
Wow.
So And when Benoit came into the stadium. Oh,
what a moment. Oh,
yeah, it was.
Oh.
We're dating ourselves. Blood.
Yes, we are.
Born then.
They're going, wait, 84? I was two. Yeah, no. It's a big moment,
but
folks.
But it was a moment.
It was huge.
But it wasn't the 95,000 people screaming in the stadium that was overwhelming. It was the 2.2 billion people watching television.
Yeah.
Because everybody knows how far 42.2 kilometers is, or 26 miles, 385 yards. They've all walked or ridden a bike or driven it or whatever. It's long.
Right.
You know, and it registers.
Yeah.
You can watch a 400 meters, and I defy you to know the difference between 45 seconds and 49 seconds.
Sure.
And it's a light year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But everybody knows distance.
Yeah. Yeah. Love that. Let's talk about 261 Fearless. I've just looked in a little bit with this. I love what I've learned about the organization. Tell us what you're doing. Tell us how it came to be. It was founded in 2015. It's having a big impact. I want to hear more, and I know our listeners do too.
Yeah. One in particular who is a woman runner who is a physician, now an author also, who gave up being a physician to join 261 Fearless.
Beautiful.
Because she was getting better outcomes from her women patients by putting them on a running program than she was with meds.
Interesting.
Okay. My old bib number. Suddenly, at along about 2013, right? 12, 13, the number starts becoming this kind of cult number, meaning fearless in the face of adversity. People were looking at that ubiquitous picture and saying they tried to throw her out. All she wanted to do was run. And they said, it makes me feel fearless, because they too, everybody listening today has been marginalized in one way or the other. You know, you've been told you're not good enough, or you're not cute, or you're the wrong race, or you're the wrong religion, or you're too poor, you're not cool, you're overweight, you live on the wrong side of the tracks. Yeah. We've heard it forever. And then you go run and you say, yeah, I can do anything.
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
I feel fearless.
Yeah.
So people were tattooing themselves even with 261. Wow. That's when I said, we got to take this seriously. And I don't want to start a business.
Right.
But I don't know what.
And I'm not going to be a tattoo artist. So what else can I do?
Well, I did get a tattoo.
Yeah, but you didn't want to be the artist with people lining up for it. Yeah, I had Catherine do my tattoo.
So this is what we did. We called it 261 Fearless and started a nonprofit. And it's very simple. The premise is that when you run, you feel fearless because you feel empowered. But there are millions and millions of women, especially, who are fearful and live in fearful situations, whether it's because of society or religious restrictions,
so
or
sad.
Poverty,
yeah,
or just you never know what's going on domestically. I mean, this fearful woman could be your next door neighbor, and you think everything's cool.
Right.
But if you take her by the hand and say, okay, I'm going to give you an hour a week with a safe community. We're going to just start running and walking together. She starts to get that sense of empowerment physically. And then we back our program up with a really good educational program with empowerment talks and courses they can take on empowerment. And we give them the opportunity with the community clubs. We're done with community clubs, and we have certified coaches with our certified program. And we should talk about this kind of certification to become qualified coaches and lead the group. And they can take you can take a nonprofit and create a business out of it. That's absolutely no reason why you can't do that. nobody's done it yet because we're too busy just trying to get women to get out and run. Sure. But it's going to have impact. Very much like Girls on the Run.
Yes, yes, yes. Women. Yeah, our kids did that. Like love, love, love that
wonderful
program.
Wonderful model.
Yes.
We studied their model really carefully. We're great friends with the Girls on the Run people. And we hope every one of those little girls grows up to be a 261 fearless woman.
Yeah. Love that.
So you know, you may think a fearful woman is under a burqa in Afghanistan, but I'm not kidding you. She's as likely as your next door neighbor. And if we can simply give women an accessible and cheap method of empowerment, I mean, this is the way to do it, is through running. Honestly, the women involved are incredible. They're incredible. Not just Juliet the doctor, but even our CEO. And we're global. You know, we're, 4 years old, and we are already in 12 countries, 5 continents.
Wow.
So.
And is it a 261fearless.org? What's the best way for people to check out?
I'm sorry. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Let me give you some publicity. 261fearless.org.
Okay.
And we'd love you to contribute and be a member, or think about starting a club and taking our training program.
Love it.
We're a little restricted right now in the training program simply because of the pandemic.
Sure.
But we're still meeting, some of us unofficially, but also the clubs are going very strong and having great virtual meetings as well in the communities where they can't meet personally.
Perfect. We'll include a link in the description too, so people can easily access that. That'd be awesome. All right. So people are sitting out there, they're listening to this, they're going, yeah. Catherine's like this amazing person. It's really cool to hear her stories, but I could never do something like that. You and I feel, we know that's not true, but what do you have to say? What can you do to encourage those folks that are coming in with that message in their heads saying, but I couldn't, she could, that's neat. And this doctor she's talking about, she's amazing, but I could never do something like that. What do you say to those folks?
Okay. The two things. One, I already talked about physically, you know, I claim I'm an ordinary person. I actually am blessed with good health. Okay. And strength. Okay. That's true. But all of us can do much more physically than we ever imagined.
Yes, yes, yes.
And we see it all the time. And, you know, if you're losing faith in human nature, go out and watch your marathon. You see cripples,
everybody,
blind people,
yes,
no arms, no legs, they're doing it.
Yes.
Okay. So that should be an inspiration for you to move, all right? And never underestimate yourself that way. But the other thing is, we are surrounded by social injustice. We are surrounded by
it. Absolutely.
And at the same time, talent is everywhere. It only deserves an opportunity. And all you have to do is give a helping hand to somebody, reach out and give an attaboy, attagirl to kids, especially your own. Keep encouraging them and motivating them like my dad did to me. But give yourself the opportunity. So you think, oh, I can't possibly do that. I'm not talking about you winning a gold medal up here. How about going around and doing your local 5K fun run?
Yeah. Yeah.
Start small.
Yeah.
Start small and build your community and reach out to your friends. Go get one or two of them together and say, hey, why don't we do this? It doesn't have to be getting the women's marathon in the Olympic Games. That started with Arnie and me getting kicked out of the AAU and forming our own club in Syracuse, New York, where 6 people showed up on a Tuesday night. And finally, it became a big club. And then it gave me the traction to and the courage to take bigger steps.
Love it.
Every little step will give you another one.
Yeah.
Start small, gather your community, get your facts in a row, educate yourself as much as possible, and never, ever underestimate yourself.
Love it. Love it. Last question, Catherine, and thank you so much for doing it. This was so fun. So fun. So thanks for making this happen. So you've lived this huge life of impact. I don't get the sense you're slowing down at all, my friend. What are you currently focused on at the age of, I think, 73 now, right? 74. Woo. And just tell us what's your journey involved now? What do you have? What's your vision? You've got a lot of energy, you're excited. What's coming down the path for you?
Well, when I ran again in Boston in 2017, that was one of my biggest eye openers because up to that point I had been telling, and because I had done this, I say, just, you're never too old to start. But you're always too young to quit, you know?
Oh, beautiful.
So that's Wally Bortz's quote. He's a great gerontologist in California. But I was starting women running at 70, 75, 80.
Love it.
When it happened to me and I ran that race, every mile got faster. I mean, I you know, I said, okay, you know, this is the anti-age, this is the aging antidote, right?
Yeah.
A lot of times when we age, I think people, they start feeling insecure or they've lost their mojo, their sexiness, their appeal, whatever. Honestly, people should realize that they've got more wisdom and more gifts to give and abilities to reach out than they ever imagined. So that is really important. For me personally, I have a few setbacks. I don't get injured often. It's usually when I do something stupid.
And I'm with you.
And recently that happened, and I'm recovering from that. But my goal actually is, and it's always good to put it out there, I really, really would love to run the Tokyo Marathon in 2022 when the race is opening.
Awesome.
And I think I could be rowdy 75. And it's not because of my age, it's because I've always wanted to run the Tokyo
Marathon. Yeah, me too.
And then maybe I can squeeze in Chicago, and then I've got my big six. But, hey, you know, here's the other thing, though, is we don't know what running looks like. Is going to look like.
Right.
And a lot of people listening right now are going to be the people who are going to make the changes or the adjustments in the sport. Right now, from my point of view, is medically, I have felt for years that a marathon event, as much as I loved it being crowded, was an epidemic waiting to happen. Because, well, look, we got 50,000 people all using the same toilets. We're hugging each other. We're sweating and we're spitting. And for 26 miles, I mean, it's not exactly hygienic.
Yeah, not a lot of social distancing going on at New York or any other marathon.
Or Boston, right. Or London.
Right.
I mean, it's body to body.
Right.
And then we hug each other, you know, and share cups of water, you know, not washing our hands too often. So those protocols are going to have to change somehow, but we can manage it. We're smart. We'll figure it out.
Right.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens to Boston in October.
Mm-hmm.
And the vaccination is not the be-all end all. I mean, this is only the beginning of a future of us really needing to save this planet, reduce our population, and clean up the mess and look to a healthier future. So we got to get really creative and we're going to have to work hard. And that's going to be, I think, a turning point for many, many people. And it could be a wonderful one. I can't imagine. This is a defining moment for the current generation, mm-hmm. just as much as for my parents, for instance, it was World War II.
Yeah.
They, from this horrible thing, can come amazing, amazing opportunities for a positive future. And I would view it myself, I think, as a huge, exciting opportunity to make change.
And let's take it, right? Beautiful. Catherine, thank you so much. This is wonderful.
Oh, Brad, thank you. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you for having me.
How cool was that? And it's fun to have this episode hit the week that runners around the world traditionally think about the iconic Boston Marathon. Hopefully next year, we can get that back on track. Thanks for tuning into the number one podcast for health and wellness coaching. Next week's episode features Dr. Kelly McGonigal, whose books include The Willpower Instinct and The Upside of Stress. I love her writing, and you're going to love the insight she shares during our discussions. If you enjoy the podcast, by the way, you might also enjoy the YouTube coaching channel, which you can find via the link that's down below or youtube.com/coaching channel. Now, let's go be a catalyst on this journey of life, making a positive difference in the world without burning ourselves out in the process. This is Dr. Bradford Cooper of the Catalyst Coaching Institute. Make it a great rest of your week, and I'll speak with you soon on the next episode of the Catalyst Health, Wellness, and Performance Coaching Podcast, or maybe over on the YouTube Coaching Channel.